Well, I've been asked by Regent University to develop a talk, a short talk, on the faint sun paradox. And I want to test it out on you guys. I mean, what I love about this class is you give me such good feedback. So this will be the first time I've publicly given this talk. And so any feedback you can give me through your questions or pointers would be appreciated. And I always begin with this slide in my public talks just to let people know, hey, if you've got questions, you can contact all of our Reasons to Believe scholars through a variety of social media. Every one of our scholars fields questions on their Facebook and Twitter page. And if you're not aware of this, Reasons to Believe has a 24/7 YouTube channel that you can sign up for and be alerted to all the video releases we're making, which are more than one per day. Another way that people can contact us is through simply going to reasons.org/the last name of the scholar. That's your portal to get free chapters of all their books. So if you want free chapters of my books, just go to reasons.org/Ross. And Improbable Planet is where I've done the most extensive writing on the faint sun paradox. But what I want to focus on is what we see in the faint sun paradox that basically establishes that the origin and history of life must be supernatural. It can't possibly be natural. And I think one of the reasons why there's a persistence to naturalism within life sciences is they don't integrate the life sciences with the physical sciences. And so historically, naturalistic models for life's origin and history only consider life sciences data. They fail to consider the role of the physics of the sun, the earth, and the moon. After all, they're studying biology. What does it matter what's going on with the earth, the moon, and the sun? Well, as you're going to see in this talk, it matters a whole lot what's going on in the physics of the sun, earth, and moon as to what the history of life on earth will look like and what's the causal, what's the cause for that life. Scientific models that provably lack explanatory scope or explanatory power are judged to be failed models. And my whole point here is that you get evolutionary biologists to say, we got a workable model, but it only works within their narrow subdiscipline. It doesn't work when you integrate it across other scientific disciplines. Matter of fact, another talk on developing is not ready yet, but I also intend to test it out here in this class, is one where we look at those evolutionary biology sciences that evolutionary biologists think give the strongest case for a naturalistic model, and basically show through a really breakthrough scientific research paper it doesn't even work at that level. And interestingly, it was non-theistic evolutionary biologists that came up with a proof. They don't acknowledge it as a proof, but I think when you get to see it, it really is a proof that based on their science alone, it does not work. Okay. The problem in evolutionary biology is they think that the sun is a stable, constant object, that it's the same billions of years ago as it is today, that it really hasn't changed. And astronomers will tell you that's simply not the case. Stars are a lot like human beings. They change throughout their history. They're not the same when they're born as when they get to be middle age, as when they get to fizzle out. This is especially the case when you look at the flaring activity of stars. Now, what's remarkable about our sun is our sun is the most stable star that we can see anywhere within our Milky Way galaxy or the universe. Stars that are more massive than the sun are less stable. Stars that are less massive than the sun are much less stable. But even when you look at stars that are exactly the mass of the sun, that are maximally stable, their stability changes throughout their lifespan. And I tell people that stars are a lot like human beings. They're unstable when they're young, they're unstable when they're old, they're maximally stable when they're middle age. Now in the case of human beings, the stability period lasts for 6 or 7 decades. Some of us, 8 decades, right? Okay. And so for most of your lifespan, you're in a stable phase. Stars are really different. They're in a stable phase for just a tiny fraction of their lifespan. So for example, This is a solar flare activity history of the sun from its very birth through to its present and on into the future. Now, to give you some sense of scale here, the vertical scale is logarithmic. There's basically about a factor of 100,000, actually close to a million times between the bottom of the scale and the top of the scale. So for example, solar flaring activity today is about a quarter of a million times less than it was when the sun first formed. And what you see here, as the sun ages from its birth, the flaring activity gets less and less and less. It hits a minimum when it's exactly middle age, and as it continues to age, it will again become unstable and begin to flare a lot. That little dotted line shows you where you get the minimum solar flaring activity. That dotted line is identical to the age of the sun right now. So the flaring minimum occurs when the sun is 4.57 billion years old. Yes? Okay, for stars that are exactly the mass of the sun, but there's another proviso, they have to be the same composition of the sun. And that's the problem. We have yet to find a star that's the same mass of the sun and the same composition of the sun. So we do see stars that are exactly the same mass of the sun, and they're more unstable than the sun because they don't have the same composition of the sun. The sun is literally the stablest star that we see. And right now, it's in the stablest part of its flaring activity. This is crucial for human civilization. To give you an idea, there was a solar flare in 1859 that, if it happened today, would be, well, it would basically knock out our internet communication, our GPS system would fail, and worse than that, it would knock out probably the majority of the world's power grids. But back in 1859, the only damage it did was to shut down the telegraph system. Telegraph operators actually got electrocuted back in 1859 as a result of the solar flare. I've written an article on this saying this is preventable. There are things we can do to protect our power grids from solar flares as big as the one that happened in 1859. You say, how many power grids are protected to that degree? Only one. The Quebec power grid. The reason they're protected is in 1989, there was a flare that knocked out the Quebec power grid. Didn't knock on anybody else's power grid. That's because Quebec was the closest to the North Magnetic Pole. And so their power grid got knocked out. They took steps to protect it. They're ready if we get another flare like we got in 1859. But no one else is ready. Yes.
How frequent are the flares like the one in 1859? Could we expect another one sometime soon?
Yeah, they typically happen like once every century or two. So the risk is real. And a number of papers have been published saying it's foolish for modern human civilization not to take out an insurance policy, because it's inevitable a flare of this nature will occur, and why not protect our power grids? I mean, it's one thing to lose your GPS communication system for a week or two. It's another thing to be without electricity for 1 or 2 years, which really could happen, where you could have power grids shut down around the world. That could take up to 2 years to put back up. And the problem there is we cannot feed 7.5 billion people without a reliable power grid. And so it just simply makes good sense that we take protection. But, you know, nothing's happened since 1859. People say, why bother? And incidentally, it wouldn't be cheap to protect all the power grids in the world. You're looking at $10 to $20 billion. On the other hand, if you get a flare like you had in 1859, you get tens of millions of people dying, minimum, and you have at least a $2 trillion cost. That's for the United States alone, not including the rest of the world. So in that sense, $10 billion or $20 billion is well worth the money.
So, something
well, you do get a 24-hour warning. If there was going to be a solar flare that was going to shut down everything like the one in 1859, you get 24 hours notice. That's because you can actually see what's going on in the sun, and you can tell whether the flare has to hit the Earth. There have been flares that big since 1859, but they've all missed us. But if one hits the Earth, then you have significant consequences. So you get 24 hours, but 24 hours is not enough to protect the power grids. Yes.
You mentioned a solar flare will happen in the future.
Yes.
And you know how the Bible talks about the sun and the moon and stars darkening, turning into blood. Do you think it could possibly be connected?
Well, those prophecies, I believe, are referring to a dust layer in Earth's atmosphere, because notice it says the sun, moon, and stars will turn red like the blood of a corpse. Their light will be dimmed by one-third. Dust will do that. Something indigenous to the sun, moon, and stars wouldn't dim them all by one-third, wouldn't all turn them into the same color. But if you get a dust layer in Earth's atmosphere, that's exactly what happens. After all, several of you have lived through forest fires here in Southern California. And when you get a forest fire, mm-hmm. what happens to the light of the sun, moon, and stars? They all turn red like the blood of a corpse, and they get about one-third dimmed. And so we've already seen that, but it's been in a local area. What we're talking about is a dust layer that encompasses the whole planet. And there's a number of scenarios where that could be brought up, but there's nothing about the physics of the sun that would cause it to turn that color or to dim that much. Okay, good question. Okay, the minimum occurs when the sun is 4.57 billion years old. Something else astronomers have discovered, and they discovered this by looking at neutrinos coming out of the sun. Neutrinos get from the nuclear furnace to the surface of the sun at the speed of light. The photons that are released from the nuclear furnace take 100,000 years to reach the surface of the sun. The photons get bounced around. And so the light that we see coming from the sun is actually generated 100,000 years ago. But here's the advantage. The neutrinos get to us virtually within 8 minutes. The photons take 100,000 years. This means astronomers can tell what's going on in the nuclear furnace of the sun today as well as 100,000 years ago. And what that tells us is that the sun entered an extremely stable luminosity phase beginning about 50,000 years ago, and it's going to last for about another 50,000 years. But also tells us that it's never happened before in the history of the sun and will never happen again. Isn't it interesting that God created human beings roughly 50,000 years ago, just at the beginning of this time when we got this extreme solar luminosity stability? And evidently, I think he intends to wrap up his work of redeeming billions of us human beings within the next 50,000 years to take advantage of this extremely period of solar luminosity. Now, this makes it clear why you want human beings on the face of the Earth when the sun is 4.57 billion years old. Of all life on planet Earth, we're the ones that are most subject to being damaged by solar flares. You know, bacteria and viruses, they can take a lot of solar flaring activity. Even plants and animals can take quite a bit. We cannot. So it makes sense that the crater would create us at this time, and also at the time when the sun enters this extreme luminosity stability phase. However, it causes a problem in the sense that the brightness of the sun is not constant. The sun begins with less mass than it has now. It accumulates mass, and actually as it rapidly accumulates mass, it quickly brightens to about twice as bright as it is now. But it reaches a point where it has the maximum mass, then it slowly loses a few percent of its mass, and because the brightness of a star goes up with a fourth power of its luminosity, we have this decline in the brightness of the sun, and then the sun stops losing mass, or at least stops losing any significant mass. And what happens then is we have the nuclear furnace, the hydrogen fusion furnace of the sun turned on, where it's fusing hydrogen into helium, and that's where the sun gets its light and heat. But as it continues to fuse hydrogen to helium, the density of the nuclear furnace gets greater and greater because helium is a higher density than hydrogen. This explains why the sun gets progressively brighter and brighter throughout the history of life on planet Earth, where today it's about 23% brighter than it was when God created the first life on planet Earth. Now, this poses a problem for two reasons. If you were to change the brightness of the sun by 2%, in other words, make it 2% less than what it is, this would cause a runaway glaciation on the surface of the Earth. Because by making the sun less luminous, instead of having rainfall on the surface of the Earth, you get snow falling on the surface of the Earth. Snow reflects sunlight, which makes the surface of the planet colder, which causes more of the precipitation to fall as snow compared to rain. And so the percentage of snow goes up and up and up. It causes more and more of Earth's surface to be covered in snow, which cools down the planet, causes more snow to fall, and very quickly the entire planet is one giant ice ball. And when it becomes one giant ice ball, all life on Earth ceases to exist, and the Earth becomes a permanent ice ball. Now, you get the counter problem if you were to make the sun slightly brighter. Now, a 4% increase in the brightness of the sun causes a runaway evaporation of all Earth's water. Because as you make the sun brighter, more of the liquid water on planet Earth evaporates and becomes water vapor. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas. It's actually the most significant greenhouse gas in Earth's atmosphere today. And therefore, as it traps heat, it causes the surface of the planet to warm up, which causes more water vapor to form, which causes the temperature to go up, and rather quickly, you have all the liquid water and all the frozen water on planet Earth transformed into steam, into water vapor. And once again, it brings about the end of all life on planet Earth by driving the temperature of the Earth up too high for life. Now, 2% seems a lot, 4% seems a lot. These are the numbers you get to have a rapid runaway glaciation or to have a rapid evaporation of Earth's water. Even a 1% change is enough to disturb the climate to make advanced life impossible on planet Earth. And as you can see by this graph, we're not talking just 1%, we're talking a 23% increase over the history of the life on planet Earth. So this is known as a faint sun paradox. The paradox is, how do you explain the continual existence of 3.8 billion years of life on planet Earth? And incidentally, you need 3.8 billion years to have human high technology civilization. Our civilization critically depends on 3.8 billion years worth of biodeposits. Think of coal, oil, natural gas. Think of marble, think of limestone, think of gypsum. These are all laid down the crust of the Earth by millions of generations of life that preceded us. But it's called a paradox because life is so intolerant to changes in the luminosity of the sun. How do we explain the fact that life has been here continuously that for that long with the sun brightening at a rate that's far greater than what life can tolerate? This was first recognized by Carl Sagan way back in the 1960s. He was the one that coined the term the faint sun paradox. And he says, clearly life has been here for that long, therefore there must be some way to compensate for the brightening of the sun. There must be factors operating the surface of the Earth that would actually work to keep the planet warm billions of years ago, in spite of the sun being as faint as it is. Now, I'm going to go through about 15 compensating factors here. This may seem a little bit tedious, and it may be tedious in the sense that these are minor compensating factors. I'm going to leave to the end the most significant compensating factors. Turns out that life is the biggest compensating factor. But the first ones that were looked at by astronomers and physicists were non-biological compensating factors. So back in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, these are the factors that they looked to compensate for the brightening of the sun, and eventually came to the recognition it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough to even compensate for one quarter of the brightening of the sun. On the other hand, there's a recognition today, all these factors do play a role. They help, but they're not the most important factors. So I'm going to run through these quickly, and feel free to ask me questions about them after we get through the list. One that was proposed is, well, if you have a lot more carbon dioxide in Earth's atmosphere billions of years ago, that would trap a lot more heat. And certainly we know there was a lot more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere billions of years ago. And another one is to say, well, more methane would help. Methane is a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And what we know is in the first billion years of life on planet Earth, a lot of the microbial life are methanogens. These are bacteria that produce methane. And so they release methane gas, and that being a greenhouse gas would have helped keep the planet warm when the sun was as faint as it was. Astronomers about a decade ago proposed nitrogen. Nitrogen is not a greenhouse gas, but has the effect of enhancing the greenhouse effect of both carbon dioxide and methane. And it's debated today whether or not there was actually more methane in the early Earth's atmosphere. It looks like there certainly was before life first appeared on planet Earth, whether there was afterwards. But it's been proposed because it's a way of enhancing the greenhouse effect of greenhouse gases. And if we have greater release of carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide and nitrogen, that would all help to enhance the greenhouse effect when the Earth was young. And then less volcanic release of ash and aerosols. Volcanoes help warm the planet through the release of carbon dioxide and nitrogen, but they help cool the planet by their ash and aerosols, which reflect away sunlight. So what scientists were proposing, maybe in the early history of the Earth, we had different kinds of volcanoes than we have today. Volcanoes don't release as much ash and aerosols, but release more carbon dioxide and nitrogen. There's some evidence that indeed that was the case. Okay, number six, a lower past albedo. And this certainly was a factor because in the early Earth, we had oceans and no continents. And oceans reflect sunlight with only 6% efficiency. Continents reflect sunlight with about 30% efficiency. So a planet with no continents or a planet with just a little bit of continental landmass coverage would indeed help to absorb more heat and light from the sun. And we do know that when we did have continents, those early continents were covered by cryptogamic crusts or cryptogamic soils. And cryptogamic soils are very dark. In fact, I'm going to show you a slide of a cryptogamic crust. Some of this stuff still exists today. You have to go to rather exotic places to see it, but it does exist. But there was a time when cryptogamic crusts or soils covered virtually all the continental land masses. And they're very dark and would help absorb more heat and light from the sun. And of course, less past continental landmass coverage, and then past continents at higher latitudes. And again, we've got evidence that in the past, instead of the continents being on the equator, they were at high latitudes, where sunlight is reflected with much less efficiency than is the case at the equator. So for example, the ice over the Himalayas reflects sunlight four times more efficiently than ice over Antarctica. And so just having the continents at higher latitudes would be a help. And then less high reflectivity clouds. Some clouds absorb sunlight, some clouds reflect sunlight. So different kind of cloud coverage. And one thing we do know is the early Earth had a lot more cloud coverage than the late Earth. And we also know the atmosphere is a lot hazier than it is today, and therefore would be able to absorb more sunlight. And then a faster past rotation rate. We do know that Earth's rotation rate is slowed by at least four times, perhaps as much as six or seven times. And the faster the rotation rate, the warmer the planet for a variety of reasons. And likewise, if you've got a greater rotation axis tilt, say instead of being 23 degrees, it's 26 degrees, then again, you get a warmer planet. And you actually see this in the Ice Age cycle. When the axial tilt drops to 24 degrees, the planet warms up. When it jumps back to 22 degrees, it cools down. And then you have a lower pass cosmic reflux. The cosmic reflux affects the reflectivity of the clouds and the formation of aerosols. And then a lower pass interstellar dust. If you've got less dust between us and the sun, then it's going to absorb less sunlight. And then greater initial solar mass. This was not recognized until about 15 years ago. One of my colleagues at Caltech, she was also a colleague of mine at the University of Toronto. She was the one that published a paper with another Caltech colleague, basically giving evidence that you not only have a faint sun paradox problem for the Earth, you got one for Mars. And we got evidence that 4 billion years ago, Mars was warm enough to have liquid water. And that would require that the sun be bright enough. And so one of the things it said is, will help resolve the faint sun paradox. If the sun had a few percent more mass 4 billion years ago or 3 billion years ago than it does today, that would actually mean that instead of the sun brightening by 30%, it only brightens by 20 to 23%. And when the faint sun paradox was first proposed by Carl Sagan, he did not take this into account and said the sun brightened by 30%. If it brightens by 30%, the scientific community a decade ago came to the conclusion there's no way out of the faint sun paradox. All these factors together cannot combine to cool a planet sufficiently in the context or have the planet warm enough billions of years ago to support life. But if we have the sun a little bit more massive, then instead of the sun getting brighter by 30%, it gets brighter by only 20 to 23%. Now, as I mentioned, these are the minor factors. But one thing I wrote in A Probable Planet, trying to resolve the faint sun paradox in the context of the sun brightening by 20 to 23% is an enormous challenge. Put all these factors together, it still is able to accommodate a lot less than half of what is needed to explain why life has been here continuously for 3.8 billion years. But this is what you see in the scientific literature. And I'm of the persuasion that of these 15, we're going to need at least a dozen to be working together. And when you see these research papers, they're basically written in a way, we think this all by itself resolves the faint sun paradox. But when you push it, it maybe can resolve 1% of the brightening, but not 20 to 23%. You need a combination to add up. But the biggest factor of all in compensating for the brightening of the sun is the history of life on planet Earth. It takes just right life on Earth at just right times. In just right life on Earth at just right times is a major compensating factor for the sun's increasing brightness. So life by itself takes care of at least two-thirds of the compensation of the brightening of the sun. And I think you can see where I'm going with this. But the biggest factor that life does in compensating for the brightening of the sun is that it regulates silicate weathering. Now, I'm going to throw some equations at you. Don't panic. These are the only ones you're going to see. And if you love chemistry, you're going to be thrilled with this. So, liquid rain falling on exposed silicates. This gives you a reason why you have to have the planet transform from a water world where you want oceans and continents coexisting. This is something the astronomical community now recognizes. For a planet to be truly habitable, it has to be a planet with oceans and continents. Because only a planet with oceans and continents can you have the possibility of silicate weathering, where progressively more and more carbon dioxide is pulled from the atmosphere, and therefore you got at least one handle on how you can compensate for the brightening of the star, because all stars brighten as they continue to fuse hydrogen into helium. Now, this works for any kind of silicate. The example I chose here was calcium silicate, and what you see here is that water acts as a catalyst. And what it does, it stimulates the reaction. Probably the thing to do is just look at the bottom equation. You've got calcium silicate plus carbon dioxide pulled from the atmosphere that is transformed through the action of water as a catalyst into calcium carbonate and silicon dioxide. And so as this reaction runs, more and more carbon dioxide is pulled from the atmosphere. And so if you have lots of carbon dioxide in the early Earth, and if this reaction runs throughout the history of life on planet Earth, progressively less and less carbon dioxide remains in Earth's atmosphere. So as the sun gets brighter and brighter, Earth's atmosphere becomes progressively less and less efficient in being able to trap heat from the sun. Now, depending on what life exists on planet Earth, this rain falling on the exposed silicates, continents are made up of silicates, and the rain falling on the silicates causes this reaction to run, but it's life on planet Earth that determines how much of the silicates get exposed to rain. So for example, in the early history of the Earth, we have these bacterial mats. And bacterial mats don't do much in breaking up the silicates. So you basically, at that time in history of the Earth, you've got silicate continents, but they tend to be rather smooth. And then you've got these bacterial mats sitting on top of the smooth rock. And so yes, there's silicate weathering going on, but it's not nearly as efficient as if you got these cryptogamic crusts. And I think now you can see just how dark this stuff is. It's virtually black. And you know, I took this in one of the Canadian high mountain meadows. That's one of the few places in the world where this stuff still exists. It only exists where it doesn't have to worry about other plants competing with it. It's a very primitive symbiotic relationship between bacteria and fungi and algae. However, this is the first time that the continental land masses now got penetrated by Earth's life. These cryptogamic colonies basically penetrated into the silicate rock and began to break it up. And therefore, more of the silicate got exposed to water, and hence it made the silicate reaction work more efficiently and pull more greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. Okay, as you move up a couple more billion years, we have plants like these ferns, and now they put roots into the silicates. And as they put roots into the silicates, they basically create pathways for the falling rain to go below the surface of the silicates and into the layer, at least several inches, if not feet, down into the layer of the silicate. And so that causes this reaction to work yet more efficiently, pulling yet more greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. And then today, this is Citadel Peak in the High Sierra Mountains. And what you see here is exposed silicate with conifer trees growing right up. And that's the amazing thing about conifers, is that they can germinate in solid rock. And as they germinate in solid rock, their roots go down and they break up the silicate. And basically, within a few million years, they can take a rock exposure like this and basically turn it into a pile of rubble and sand, just by the way their roots penetrate. But as their roots go down, not just a few inches, but go down 20, 30, 40 feet, what they do is they expose huge areas of the silicate to falling rain. And then we get a wonderful byproduct from this. Notice in that chemical reaction, the net result is you've got the transformation of silicate rock into carbonates and sand. Silicate is a low-quality industrial product. We don't really use it to build anything. But the carbonates and sand are the basis for concrete. They're the basis for our buildings. And you know, there was no sand on the early Earth. In fact, what's interesting is that in certain parts of Asia, there's a sand shortage. You know, they're trying to build their highways and their skyscrapers, and yet because the population is so dense there, they really don't have enough sand. And so that's why they're hoping that we in California will be willing to sell sand on our beaches so they can take it back home and turn it into freeways and skyscrapers. Believe it or not, there's actually a sand shortage on planet Earth. And it's a crisis in the sense that that's exactly what's happening. Poor nations are selling their beach sand because of the demand for sand in other parts of the world. But this silicate reaction is basically the source of sand and carbonates. We shouldn't complain. What's happening in Duarte? Didn't Duarte sell one of their mountains so it could be transformed into rock and sand? So. Azusa did that. Okay, not Duarte, it's Azusa. Sorry, I shouldn't blame Duarte. All right. But isn't that weird where cities will actually sell one of their mountains so it can be chopped up to make building materials? Okay, that's the biggest contributor that life makes. But I think you're getting my point here. You need different life at different times in order to regulate the rate at which the silicate reaction runs, so you're pulling out the precise amounts of carbon dioxide you need to compensate for the brightening of the sun. Life's second biggest compensation happens through the burial of organic carbon. I mean, what light does, it takes carbon out of the atmosphere, mainly carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and transforms it into sugars, starches, and fats. But if the life gets buried below the surface of the Earth, then all that carbon from the atmosphere gets sequestered in the crust, and because Earth has aggressive plate tectonics going on, it actually gets sequestered into the mantle. And so over the history of life on planet Earth, we've seen progressively more and more carbon being pulled to the atmosphere and be driven through erosion and plate tectonics into the crust of the Earth and down into the mantle of the Earth. Now, some of that is released back to the atmosphere through volcanoes, but the truth is there's been more carbon pulled from the atmosphere than carbon released back to the atmosphere because of the efficiency with which organic carbon is buried. That also explains where we get our coal, oil, and natural gas and limestone. So you get a thick rainforest like this, you get water running through the rainforest, and it pulls all this dead vegetation and animal material down. It gets buried by the erosion, but not just erosion. You get the plate tectonics driving it deep into the crust of the Earth and into the mantle of the Earth. Now, to make all this work, you need a planet with very aggressive, efficient plate tectonic activity. And it's now recognized by astronomers that there is no planet that equals our planet in terms of the aggressiveness with which plate tectonics operates and how long it's able to be sustained. Efficient silicate erosion or organic carbon burial both require enduring aggressive plate tectonics. Now, I'm actually in the process of writing a book on all the factors that are needed to make this happen. And incidentally, we didn't always have plate tectonics. When the Earth was very young, incidentally, one of the big reasons why we have aggressive plate tectonics that's long-lasting is because our planet Earth is uranium-thorium champion of the universe. We are super endowed with uranium and thorium, 340 times as much uranium as other rocky planets, 630 times as much thorium. And it's the radioactive decay of uranium and thorium that drives the plate tectonics. But when the Earth was young, the heat release from uranium and thorium is so great that it caused a very thick crust to form, which made for a stagnant lid, and therefore there was no plate tectonics in the early history of the Earth. And when the heat from uranium and thorium decay subsided a little bit, that allowed the plates to form. And because we didn't only have the radioactivity, we also had photosynthetic life. Okay, long-lasting plate tectonics requires enduring, abundant photosynthetic life. And this is because you need heat, surface heat, not just interior heat from the uranium-thorium decay, but surface heat. And what photosynthetic life does is that it produces oxygen, and the oxygen causes uranium precipitates to form as a result of photosynthetic life. And if you have powerful erosion forces that are moving these photosynthetically produced uranium precipitates off of the continents, into the oceans, and in the region where you've got plate boundaries at the subduction zones, the heat released from those uranium precipitates generates a chemical reaction at the boundaries of two plates, and basically produces a reaction where the combination of dense water and those uranium precipitates and the heat released from the uranium precipitates makes talc. Talc is a lubricant, so that actually causes the plates to slide underneath one another. If you don't have that very dense water at the boundaries of tectonic plates, and if you don't have adequate uranium precipitates produced by photosynthetic life, the plates will not slide underneath one another, and you're not going to get the efficient burial of carbon into the deep crust and into the mantle. And so, yes, first you need abundant, dense water at the plate boundaries. You need, by the way, water has six different properties. Liquid water, so we got type 1 liquid water, type 2 liquid water, all the way down to type 6 liquid water. Type 6 liquid water is the densest water, and you need that super dense water, and that happens when the water is 4 degrees centigrade. And so if you've got deep water where it's going to be under pressure, then it will be class 6 water, and that's the water you need to generate this chemical reaction. And you need the photosynthetic life bringing uranium precipitates to the subduction zones. You need powerful enduring radioactivity, which we have, and you need a powerful enduring dynamo in Earth's interior. I mean, Earth's interior is special in that it's got a solid inner core made up of iron and cobalt, nickel, which are magnetic. And now there's some geophysicists thinking that in addition, there's probably a lot of uranium in that solid core. I mean, where else are you going to put the huge quantity of uranium? Then outside of that solid core, you're going to have a liquid core made up of iron, cobalt, and nickel, and that's magnetic and it's circulating, and that's what generates the magnetic field of the Earth. Yes? Let's get the microphone over to Ross.
Going back to what you said a minute ago, if the talc wasn't produced, would it prevent earthquakes, or would it make them less frequent but more severe because the pressure would build up for a longer period of time?
It depends. You either get a planet with no earthquakes at all, or you get planets with intermittent, very severe earthquakes. Either way, it's not good for long life to exist on planet Earth. So yeah, the amount of talc being produced is crucial. And you need oceans of just the right depth. Earth started off with oceans that were too deep. I mean, one of the problems if you get, a normal Earth-like planet has oceans that are thousands of miles deep rather than just 3 or 4 or 5 miles deep. And when you get oceans that deep, you get another kind of ice forming. Ice that's actually denser than the densest water. And when that happens, you get an ice layer that separates the liquid water from the rocky planet, which means there's no capacity for the water to chemically engage the rocky material. And when that happens, there's no possibility for life, and there's no possibility for any kind of compensation reaction to deal with the brightening of the star. So yeah, it needs to be fine-tuned. And incidentally, these are the fourth most significant factors. There's dozens more that need to be fine-tuned to get the just right tectonic activity going. As I mentioned earlier, in the early history of the Earth, there was too much heat being released from the uranium and thorium decay to allow plate tectonics start up. There'll come a time in the future, and it's not that far off, when the heat release from the uranium and thorium will not be adequate to sustain plate tectonics. So Earth began with what's called a stagnant lid, where no tectonics is going on. In the near future, that stagnant lid will come back. And so what that means is there's another reason why we get this window of about 3.8 billion years where we can have life on planet Earth. But also implies we human beings are at the end of that window, because you have plate tectonics is going to shut down. Another problem is that we can no longer compensate for the brightening of the sun. I mean, the way we've been compensating for 3.8 billion years is progressively pulling more and more carbon dioxide and methane out of the atmosphere. The problem is photosynthesis needs a minimum amount of carbon dioxide to operate. And during the last ice age, the carbon dioxide level fell to a point where it was sufficient to stop photosynthesis at high latitude or high altitudes. It was fine near sea level, but was sufficient to stop it at high altitudes. There's concern that the next ice age that we face could actually drop the carbon dioxide level. So what is that level? About 150 parts per million. How low did it get during the last ice age? It got down to 160 to 170 parts per million. So if it gets below 150, then photosynthetic life shuts down. It's not the end of all life on planet Earth, but will be the end of all life as dependent on photosynthetic life, and that includes us human beings. So there's a limit to how much carbon dioxide you can pull of the sun to compensate for the sun. That's another reason why I believe we're close to the end of the window of time for the existence of life here on planet Earth. But before you panic, recognize I'm an astronomer. When I talk about it being soon, I don't mean tomorrow. I mean sometime in the next few tens of millions of years. So, but to review, these are the four ways that light compensates for the brightening of the sun. The most important way is through the erosion of silicates that pulls carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. The second most important way is through the burial of organic carbon. A third way that's now being recognized in the scientific literature, different life on Earth at different times affects the chemistry of the atmosphere, and especially the cloud cover, and whether you get high reflective clouds or clouds that absorb a lot of sunlight. And then the fourth factor is it changes Earth's reflectivity. So notice that some plants have bright colors and therefore reflect sunlight efficiently, and some plants have dark colors and absorb sunlight. So by changing what kind of vegetation you have in the Earth, that can help to compensate for the brightening of the sun. But the bottom line to all of this is you're going to need to have just the right light on planet Earth at just the right time. And if you don't, you're going to get out of sync with what's happening to the physics of the sun, and the planet becomes permanently sterile, permanently devoid of all life. Which means that someone with a mind who knows the physics of the sun, Earth, and moon must remove no longer compensating life and replace it with just right life forms at just right times in just right amounts at just right conclusions. Natural processes will not know what's going to be happening in the future physics of the sun. They won't have the capacity for anticipating, okay, this is what's going to happen to the physics of the sun, the Earth, and the moon. And you say, well, how are you bringing the moon into this? The moon affects the tides of the Earth. The moon affects the rotation of the Earth. And so the moon's physics plays a role as well. But it takes a mind who understands all that future physics of the sun, Earth, and moon to know which life to remove from the planet and which life to replace that removed life with. This is significant because a lot of evolutionary biologists have been very critical of Christian creationism by saying, look, what we see in the fossil record is we have these mass extinction events followed by mass speciation events. Why would a good God, an all-powerful good God, wholesale remove life from planet Earth and replace it with different life? Well, the faint sun paradox explains why that's exactly what a loving, all-powerful God would do. As the physics of the sun, moon changes, he removes life from planet Earth and replaces it with new life that's more efficient in pulling greenhouse gases out of the Earth's atmosphere. And so as you look at the history of Earth, you see that roughly every 30 million years, there's a mass extinction event followed by a mass speciation event. And if you look at the way the sun's physics is changing over the past 4 billion years, an intervention about once every 30 million years is exactly what you need to keep in step with the changing physics of the sun, Earth, and moon. As I've shared with a number of evolutionary biologists, this model is actually a biblical model. It's stated in the longest creation psalm that we see in the Bible, Psalm 104. You go to verses 29 and 30, referring to life on planet Earth. It says, they die and return to the dust. When you send your spirit, they are created and renew the face of the earth. So here we actually have a biblical creation text telling us this is exactly what God does. It's a property of all life to die off, and when it dies off, God recreates and renews the face of the earth with different life forms that are more efficient than pulling greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere. And so here we see the history of life on planet Earth, and we see through the faint sun paradox and how life at just the right time, at just the right place, in just the right abundance, and just the right ecological diversity is able to step by step compensate for the brightening of the sun, but also in such a way that planet Earth gets progressively more and more diverse in its life. And one of the things that just got discovered a year ago is that throughout this long history of life on planet Earth, the number of species of life on Earth has progressively increased, and it hit a maximum at the origin of human beings. When God created Adam and Eve, there were about 8.5 million eukaryotic species on the face of the earth. Biologists have yet to be able to accurately number the number of prokaryotes. The prokaryotes are the primitive bacterial species that don't have a nucleus inside their cells. Eukaryotes do have a nucleus inside the cells, and they've been able to determine how that number increased with time, but it hit a maximum at the origin of human beings. There's less species in that now, mainly because human activity has caused some of those species to go extinct. But it is interesting, God put us human beings on the face of the earth when we had the greatest diversity of life and the greatest abundance of life. So we were here when life hit a maximum abundance and a maximum diversity. And as you look at the solar flaring activity, what you notice is that God first creates the microbes. And the first microbes he creates are extremely radiation tolerant. And so they're able to thrive in spite of the enormous flaring activity of the sun. And with that flaring activity also comes a lot of ultraviolet radiation and X-ray radiation. And as that radiation and flaring activity subsides, he creates progressively more and more advanced life. Now, from a naturalistic evolutionary perspective, you'd expect that life would become less and less advanced with respect to time as a result of the operation of the second law of thermodynamics. What we see instead is that life becomes progressively more and more advanced. And then when it hits the minimum, we see the most advanced life. And to conclude, you have this passage in Psalm 104, verse 24, "How many are your works, O Lord? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures." As you read the entirety of Psalm 104, it's basically making the point, no matter where you go on planet Earth, you will find life. You'll find life in the greatest possible abundance and the greatest possible diversity. The psalm written by David is basically making the point that at the time we humans are here, this is the status of life on planet Earth. Or as you see the prophet Isaiah, he did not create the earth to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. He formed it to be filled with life of all kinds of species and diversity, not just so that we human beings would have the biodeposits we needed, but we would actually have all the plant and animal resources we needed to launch and sustain our civilization. You see this in Job 38 and 39, that just before he created human beings, he created cows and donkeys and horses and goats and sheep and the various kinds of birds that would enable us to quickly launch agricultural activity and to use that to produce a huge abundance of food, set our population free from trying to scrounge up enough food where they could engage in religion and art and literature and science and technology. Again, you can read a lot more about this in Improbable Planet and the book I got coming out next year on interior designs. Yes. Get the microphone for this. Mark?
A couple slides back there on the graph. When you showed the sun's luminosity and the life, where life occurred, where it started, and where we're at today. I was wondering, yeah, that one. Like an M-class star, you know, a red dwarf, do they go through a similar cycles as our yellow star?
Okay. Most of the stars in our galaxy are like 80% the mass of the sun or less. And that makes up about 90% of all stars. They go through a similar process but it's much more stretched out. So, like an M-type star, instead of being burning for 9 or 10 billion years, will burn for 100 billion years. And people say, well, that means you would have a period where you wouldn't have that much brightening of the star. One problem, however, is M-type stars, no matter what age they are super flaring stars. And so, so you're going to have a flaring problem. And in fact, I'm writing a blog right now. I think it's going to be released this Monday, based on the British geophysicist Dave Waltham, who said, one problem with going to stars that are fainter than the sun is that, yes, they're more numerous, but they're going to be going through this brightening at a less pace than we see here with our sun. And in order to compensate for the brightening of the sun, you need all this aggressive plate tectonic activity going on. You need all this life. And he says the problem is it'll be too aggressive for that kind of a star. So he's making the interesting point is that not only do you need the planet to be just like the Earth with the super aggressive plate tectonic activity going on and the super abundant life, the sun or the star needs to be just like the sun. Because if you're going to be able to have this compensation work, you need all these factors in place. But if all those factors are in place, they will be overcompensating for a star like an M-type star or a K-type star. So he's basically written a paper making the point that will happen with planets that have all these factors in place to compensate. If they're orbiting a fainter star, they're going to become ice balls because they're going to cool the planet too quickly. Earth orbiting the sun cooled the planet enough that it didn't become an ice ball. Yes. Got one on the internet?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
Doug wants to know what steps can be taken to protect the power grids.
What steps can be taken to protect the power grids? Well, when you get a really big flare, you get a surge of energy running through the power grid. And so basically what you do, you put in surge protectors. And we do that with our computers, right? But to protect a power grid, you need big, expensive surge protectors. For example, the Quebec power grid, they had to spend $1.3 billion Canadian to protect their power grid from a solar flare several times bigger than the one they experienced in 1989. They're not even certain it could protect them from a flare like the one in 1859, but certainly it will adequately protect them from a flare that's, say, three or four times the size of what they suffered in 1989. Now, they considered it a good investment because when that flare hit, it shut down the Quebec power grid for a whole day. And that cost them $10.5 billion. Because Quebec exports a lot of electricity to cities like New York and Boston. And so that income was cut off. Moreover, the whole Quebec economy was shut down for a day. And that's a relatively small power surge. So they were able to get up and running fairly quickly. But they said, you know, if we're going to lose $10 billion a day, it's worth spending $1.3 billion to protect it. But it still ranks as the only protected grid in the world. But it has gotten the attention of our government saying, you know, if we have a big flare, we're looking at a minimum $2 trillion cost. And given the status of our national debt, I'm not sure we could handle another $2 trillion. Okay, anyone else? I saw some hands over here. Yes.
What caused
Wait.
Surge.
What causes a surge besides lightning?
What causes what?
A power surge.
What causes a power surge? Okay. This flare basically causes the whole, I mean, you get a Northern Lights thing going on. So it really enhances the power that's in Earth's magnetosphere. And that power leaks out to the surface of the Earth. And that's why the Quebec power grid was hit in 1989, because it was in the most energetic spot of Earth's magnetosphere. And so that energy basically zapped their power grid. Didn't do anything to the American power grids because they were far enough away from the densest part, and densest energy part of our magnetosphere. And by the way, back in 1989, I remember that event because it was the first time that I've ever seen the Northern Lights here in Los Angeles. I don't know how many of you joined me in having that experience. It was a big red spot basically over the south part of LA in the sky. So that's the only time I've ever seen the Northern Lights here in Los Angeles. But the one in 1859, the Northern Lights were so intense that it woke people up in the middle of the night. That's how bright it was. And the people were seeing it in the Gulf of Mexico. So, you know, by the way, having grown up in Canada, we used to curse the Northern Lights because it forced us to stop doing our astronomical observations. The Northern Lights would get so bright and so spectacular, you really couldn't see anything. All you could see was the Northern Lights. I mean, it really looked like a laser show. Colors changing everywhere, things moving rapidly across the whole sky. So we would just shut down the telescope and enjoy the show. So, but it meant we couldn't do any observations. So, and incidentally, you do get a warning. If you've never seen the Northern Lights, you get a 24-hour ahead notice. And so if you watch the NASA website, they've got a place you can go on the internet, which basically watches what's happening with the sun. And they can tell you, a big flare is coming, it's going to hit our magnetosphere, we're going to have a spectacular Northern Lights, this is the time to book a flight to the Yukon and get to see the Northern Lights. Or just book a flight to Winnipeg, I mean, you know, or Edmonton, that'll be adequate if you'd be able to see the Northern Lights. Anyone else? Yes.
You comment on that, I guess it's not quite a new satellite, the solar one that's up there I've been seeing in the news. It's supposed to be getting real close to the sun. Are you familiar with that one?
Well, there's several solar observatories, and yet typically they're not in orbit around the Earth. They put them in orbit around the sun so they can observe the sun 24/7. And there are three of them that are in that role right now, and each one is designed to measure different things from the sun. And you know, they're trying to understand what's going on in the interior of the sun to a greater degree than we've been able to do so far. And it's these measurements that are telling us the sun is extremely stable. So it's confirming what we learned from the neutrinos, that we're at a very blessed time in the history of the sun. As far as being able to predict future solar flares, it can't do that. We do know there's a relationship between sunspots and solar flares. The one in 1859, there was an enormous sunspot on the sun. You could see it with the naked eye if you had shielded glasses. It was that big, you could see the sunspot. And incidentally, there was a flare in the 7th century that was five times bigger than the one in 1859. So one thing you're going to see in my book on weathering climate change, I have a chapter on the sun where I talk about solar climate and what our risk is for different kinds of solar flares. And one that would be the end of human civilization, that only happens once every 30,000 years. The end of humanity, maybe once every million years. The end of civilization as we know it, about once every 100 to 200 years. So there is a significant risk. And it is interesting that we insure for lots of things that are less risky than what we're facing with the physics of the sun. In the back.
Yes, how do you answer to someone who tells you, ask you, of all the billions of stars and planets in the universe, what is the probability that there's a planet like ours, or there's life there?
Well, that's a question that is the discipline of astrobiology. Astrobiology got launched in the 1990s based on the discovery of planets outside of our solar system. And the running joke in astrobiology is that it still ranks as the only data-free discipline. We've yet to find any life outside of planet Earth. Well, I've been on record since the 1980s. We will find at least the remains of life on virtually every solar system body, simply because of how prolific life is on planet Earth. Every time big meteors hit the Earth, we lose soil to interplanetary space. And 1 ton of Earth's soil has got 100 quadrillion microbes in it. And so this search for life on Mars, we're going to find the remains of life on Mars, but it'll be the remains of Earth-transported life. But a much better place to find the remains of life outside of planet Earth would be the Moon. The Moon has received more than 100 times as much life as Mars has from Earth. And so that would be the easiest place to find the remains of life on another solar system body. But the planets or the moons of Jupiter will also have the remains of Earth life, but it'll be very difficult to find. However, the remains of Earth life cannot be transported in any recognizable form to planets beyond our solar system. So it'll be limited to what we see in our solar system. And one thing that's happened through 25 years of astrobiology research is a growing recognition that outside of the solar system, the universe is hostile to life. In fact, several of you were at the debate I had with Victor Stenger at Caltech, in which he used that argument against the Christian faith. His argument was, if God is all-powerful, all-loving, why would he make the whole universe hostile to life except planet Earth? If he really loved, he would have created it everywhere. And the fact that we astronomers look out there, everything looks hostile, tells us it can't be an all-powerful, all-loving God. Of course, he was presuming that God had no other purpose for creating the universe than to make it a habitat for life. And that's not the Christian message at all. But yeah, everywhere we look, we see hostility. Now, we haven't looked everywhere. I mean, there's still a possibility that we look hard enough, we might find a place. In fact, a number of my colleagues think we may possibly find a planet on which primitive microbes exist. But they do agree finding a planet where the equivalent of humans exists or even advanced animals exists is extremely remote, in spite of the huge number of planets in the universe. And part of the problem is this. The farther away we look, where you can get that large sample size, the farther back in time you see. And one of the things we've learned from the study of life on planet Earth is that life was created on planet Earth at the earliest time the physics of the universe would permit. You can't have the origin of life happening any earlier than about 10 billion years after the cosmic creation event. And likewise, you can't have advanced life appearing until about 3.5 billion years after the primitive life that appears on planet Earth. And so several papers have been published just in the past year and a half making the point, if there is advanced life elsewhere in the universe, it's after us, it can't be before us. We're the first. So, and maybe that will dampen your enthusiasm for the Star Wars movie coming out next week. Is that there can't be all these thousands of planets with advanced life on it, because we're the first one that can be even possibly existing given the laws of physics. Okay, anyone else before we jump back into our lesson on Isaiah? Okay, over here.
So how does all this fit into the story of Genesis?
Well, I've mainly developed this talk, and maybe you can give me some feedback on how effective this was, to make the point that the reigning paradigm that you see in evolutionary biology, we can explain the history of life by natural means alone. I basically made the point here, just look at the simple sciences of physics, astronomy, and geology, where things are orders of magnitude less complex than they are in the life sciences. And we see by looking at that, it's clear that we need a mind who knows the future physics of the sun, earth, and moon to know which life to remove from planet Earth and which life to replace that remove life with. If you don't have exactly the right life on planet Earth at exactly the right time and location and just the right abundance and diversity, you quickly get out of sync with the changing physics of the sun and the Earth, and the planet becomes sterile. And so naturalistic processes will not have that mind that knows the future physics and therefore can plan and accommodate and compensate for the future changing physics of the Earth, Moon, and Sun. So that was kind of the main premise I was making here. And basically it fits into the biblical creation texts who make the point that it takes supernatural intervention to explain the origin of life, to explain the origin of soulish animals, to explain the origin of human beings. Natural process plays a role, but it's not an adequate role in explaining the history of life. So hopefully that point got across. If it didn't, I need to hear from you, because that's really the whole reason. In fact, I'd like to hear from any of you if you got any comments or critiques or recommendations. Looks like John has some. Go ahead.
Yes, isn't it also true that in the semantic range of the original Hebrew, the word yom, which is translated as day in many translations, actually is an unspecified length of time, and that in some other passages of the Bible, it corresponds to periods of centuries, and that it really, the proper English translation would be time, and then the context would determine its length, so that the biblical text is actually perfectly consistent with the scientific data that indicates lengths of billions of years.
Well, it is. So a good point that John is making, that the Hebrew word yom is used for the creation days in Genesis 1, has multiple literal definitions. It can mean 24 hours. It can mean part of the daylight hours. It can mean all the daylight hours. Or it can mean a long period of time. However, it has to be a finite time period. You can't use the word yom to refer to indefinite time. But time that is finite included. So you can easily take Genesis literally and have it read as six ages of time, six consecutive ages of time. And that kind of fits what you see in Psalm 104, where it talks about how it's a property of all life to die off. But when it dies off, God replaces the life and renews the face of the earth. You know, you're not going to fit that into a 6,000-year time scenario. And you're talking about sufficient time where life is literally going to die off and need to be replaced. In the context of the physics of the sun, again, we're looking at billions and billions of years. And also realizing God wanted us humans to launch the civilization of adequate technology that we can take the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. And that's going to take an enormous treasure chest of biodeposits to make that possible. You know, what if God put Adam and Eve on this planet with no coal, no oil, no natural gas, no limestone, no marble, and no concentrated metals? I mean, this is often not taken into account. That long history of bacterial life on planet Earth is what concentrated the metal ores, transformed the metals on Earth from being very dilute soluble metals into concentrated insoluble metal ores. And if we didn't have those concentrations of insoluble metal ores, we would have never launched metallurgy. And without metallurgy, we couldn't have the civilization that's needed to take God's redemptive message to all the people groups of the world. So often what I share with young Earth creationists, you could have it two ways. God could use different physics, where he puts the universe and Earth and everything we need together in just thousands of years, but he takes billions of years to redeem the number of humans he wants to redeem. Or he could take billions of years to prepare everything just right for us and take just thousands of years to redeem billions of us. You know, which do you think would be more favorable from our human perspective? Personally, I like the latter. Okay, I'm actually out of time. I thought I was going to get to spend some time in the in our Isaiah study. We'll get to that next week. And once I got the talk ready on how you can actually establish supernatural intervention for life based on just the one science of evolution or biology, based on some new studies about the genomes, I'll give you that too. But again, any feedback you got from what you heard today, feel free to send me an email. Or if you think of something at the party tonight, feel free to share it with me. I often think of my best critique of a talk several hours after I've heard the talk. So if you're like me, I'll be at the party. So thank you, and Merry Christmas to all of you. Okay.